cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser with Matt Miller, who is in for Tim Stenovic, who is on leave. Now, one storyline that caught our attention this past week that didn't involve the Fed or talk of a recession or that mega merger between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. Instead, it was about the future of crypto. We're going to have more on that in just a moment. Also ahead, we'll hear from the head of the $1.5 trillion asset manager, PGIM. David Hunt stopping by the Bloomberg Invest Conference here at our company headquarters and talked about why he's not yet ready to believe in bulls. Plus, our cover story on how the U.S. lost the electric vehicle battery race to China and our very belated attempt to catch up. All of that to come. We begin with news this past week. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission widening its sweeping crackdown on cryptocurrencies by accusing Coinbase Global of running an illegal exchange, a move that could make it harder for the industry to operate and for U.S. citizens to trade. Now, the move coming one day after the regulator sued rival Binance Holdings, alleging a slew of violations. This was all top of mind when Matt and I sat down with former SEC Chairman Jay Clayton, who is non-executive chair at Apollo Global Management, and senior policy advisor at Sullivan & Cromwell, along with Dan Moorhead, founder and CEO of the crypto venture fund Pantera Capital. They joined us just after a panel discussion that I did on the same topic during our Bloomberg Live Invest Conference at Bloomberg Global Headquarters in New York.
First of all, let's just do some of the stuff that we went on in the panel. And we talked about crypto specifically. Big week when it comes to cryptocurrencies. I know, Jay, I kind of put you on the spot about saying, do we think Chair Gensler is doing the right thing? How do you see cryptocurrencies longer term?
Well, I think we talked about that.
Yeah.
People refer to crypto and they think of a product. Crypto is really a technology. It's blockchain technology, distributed ledger technology that manifests itself in many products. I believe that 10 years from now, there will continue to be blockchain-based products. I expect that blockchain or some transformative technology like it will come to the traditional financial system, and we're going to see that. I think we should be looking to accommodate that. And then at the same time, there are products that clearly have been offered, sold, and traded inconsistent with our rules. And we've got to deal with that.
Dan, I want you to weigh in on what happened this week.
Yeah, so I think Jay's point spot on is that, you know, it's a very important technology. 300 or 400 million people are already using it. We just have to establish rules that allow entrepreneurs in the space to build things so that we can keep growing the technology, especially domestically, rather than pushing it offshore.
I mean, there was so much fraud, there was so much pump and dump, there was so much, you know, so many rug pulls. Clearly, a lot of the coins that we saw ICO over the past few years should have been dealt with by the SEC. So I think, you know, even people in the industry are probably happy about that. What is left, Dan? You know, aside from blockchain, what else is there that's not a security in terms of tokens?
Well, anytime you have a very disruptive new technology, people try a lot of things. In hindsight, some didn't work, right? And if you think back to the dot-com boom, there were a lot of ideas that were tried. And I guess we didn't want to buy cans of pet food on the internet, right? But like a lot of other ideas,
not until
Chewy. Well, we are now.
You know, yeah. Now everybody buys literally everything for his pet on the internet.
Exactly, and that's one of my favorite things. Nobody remembers who the dope was that was majority owner of Pets.com. It was this guy who thought the technology would be really impactful. Tried pet food, that didn't work. He also tried books, and so Jeff Bezos is doing fine, even though he was the majority owner of Pets.com. And that's basically what's happening in the token space. We're trying a lot of ideas. Some, like Ethereum, you know, work really well, and some just didn't work well.
Well, when it comes to the regulatory framework, Jay, can we compare what's going on in blockchain and crypto to the dot-com era? Is it apples to apples or not necessarily?
I think it rhymes. I think it rhymes.
Oh, you do?
I do. We talked a little about this before.
Yeah.
Look at the stable coin. I say the stable coins that were truly stable, truly backed. Look at the uptake in that and the efficiencies that created. Now, if we can have that kind of retail dollar, you know, basically digital dollar,
right?
People talk. That's what a stable coin, a truly well-functioning, well-structured, well-regulated stable coin is, a digital dollar. The power of that versus the power of carrying cash, think about it.
It's fantastic, but it still is like pulling teeth, getting Tether to properly report, you know, everything that it holds. Disclosure is key, isn't it, Dan? Why don't people just come up with it?
It is, and obviously I can't speak for why Tether doesn't do that, but USDC, that's done by Circle and Coinbase, incredibly transparent, incredibly stable, it's backed by, you know, very short-term, high-quality treasury debt. That is something you can really see what it is, and, you know, frankly, it's a lot more transparent than a bank is. I have no idea what my bank's actually doing with my money.
We learned that this year, right? I mean, a lot of people didn't realize.
We're going to let Jay come in on that.
To Matt's point, look, regulation has to have all the key elements. It has to have investor protection. We learned that, right? It has to have prudential regulation, you know, for the system. It has to have that. And it also has to have AML, KYC, you know, the law enforcement, illicit activity, deterrence. You've got to get those things right, but you can get those things right and still have innovation.
By the way, that's another thing that's come out this year. Not that it surprised anybody, but a number of crypto firms were like instructing clients how to use VPNs in order to essentially cheat the system, right? Does that happen on in traditional finance on Wall Street as well, or have they learned their lesson not to mess with the SEC in that way?
I think most retail products, activity like that is non-existent or aggressively and effectively deterred.
You were laughing.
No, I appreciate that. You know, anybody that's committing a crime or a fraud should be hammered, right? Like that, I agree with that.
But I will say, you know, our markets, one of the areas where we have the most difficulty as regulators is activity that takes place offshore that affects our markets. That is one of the more difficult places. And I'll tell you that when I was at the SEC, you know, trades came in large batches from offshore. Large batch trades make it difficult to detect illicit activity. One of the things that we did was unbatch those trades,
right,
so that people couldn't combine what was fraudulent or illicit activity with otherwise, you know, legitimate trading.
Jay,
I did kind of wonder after over the last few years, every time I interviewed Sam Bankman-Fried, I was like, why is this effective altruist in the Bahamas? Is it just that he likes the sun? Is he just a beach guy?
Probably
at heart?
Not.
You know, he didn't seem like a beach guy.
What I'm curious is, when you look back at your time at the SEC, is there something that you wish you had done more of when it comes to crypto and blockchain?
Well, look, anytime you look back, I mean, you know, you look back at this interview, you're going to say, gosh, I wish I asked him that. So when you look back, you always, you know, that's human behavior.
But you do look back. Like, is there something you thought you wish you had done?
Oh, sure. Look, I do think that a safe place for this innovation is stablecoin. And I wish that we had worked together across the federal financial regulators to give a clear indication of what is a very safe, well-regulated stablecoin that touches all those places: investor protection, stability, AML, KYC, deterrence of illicit activity. I think that it's doable, and I wish we'd done it.
Yeah. So it's great that we're getting some regulatory clarity here, even if it's not the kind of clarity that everybody would have wanted. Are we, though, killing the industry in this country, Dan? I mean, is it a problem that, you know, we're going to talk about battery technology a little bit later on and how U.S. regulation basically destroyed our chances of leading in that technology, and now China owns it, right? Car batteries, electric car batteries. Are we doing the same thing right now to crypto?
Well, there has been a very pronounced movement to have crypto companies based outside the United States. And so I think it is different than the way the U.S. treated the internet itself, where all the large internet companies are based in the U.S.
So that's a bad thing. I mean, because that is like what San Francisco is all about now.
Well, and I'm going to go back to – go ahead.
No, and look, we have a couple of recent data points, and they're just recent data points, but foreign governments are using the blockchain to issue sovereign debt as a test case. Yeah. And if they're doing that, they're thinking – do we have an efficiency assisting technology, an enhancing technology here? And you're seeing governments support that question, support the answer to that question. I think we ought to be doing that too.
We're seeing it now today with AI as well.
Well, we kicked off the conversation today. I was saying, let's look at climate and what's going on. And you said, we need to have global cooperation in order for anything to be productive and get done, correct?
Yes.
And it's the same thing with crypto and blockchain.
But why are you worried about the climate, Carol?
Because I'm going to be living in the metaverse wearing
the Apple
headset.
No, because we can't breathe when we go outside in New York City where 10% of all United States financial activity happens. Like, it's a big problem for the economy and for my daughter.
Real quickly, because we only have about a minute left, 30 seconds on how you see the market, the broader market environment right now. Because there's mixed data.
Yeah, so I still think that rates have to be high for longer than most people think. There's no working age person that's traded in a rising rate environment. And so we all keep thinking, it's just buy the dip. And there was a 42-year bull market in rates. There might be a 4 or 5 year bear market in rates. And it might impact interest rate sensitive sectors like stocks, real estate. And that's why I do think blockchain's nice, because it's not interest rate sensitive.
Saved you 25 seconds. Outlook, broad macro.
We continue to be surprised to the upside, and we should ask ourselves why.
That was former SEC Chairman Jay Clayton, along with Pantera Capital's Dan Moorhead, with me and Matt Miller. Coming up, we'll hear from another event participant who offered a stark assessment of current market conditions. PGIM CEO David Hunt is coming up next. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
On Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube.
You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, the once hot Wall Street trades of 2023 are all falling apart, and a fresh blow to market pros blindsided again and again ever since the pandemic broke out. Nearly halfway into the year, a slew of consensus bets are losing big time as the U.S. economy defies the recession bears, the artificial intelligence craze heating up, and more. So for all you naysayers on tech, the U.S. dollar, and for those talking up emerging markets in China, you better think again. All of this, the backdrop of Bloomberg Live's Invest event this week, where my co-host Matt Miller caught up with PGIM CEO David Hunt. This conversation from Wednesday, just after David took part in a panel discussion entitled Today's Assets, From Safe and Secure to Risky and Untouchable.
Safe and secure right now is pretty interesting because, for two reasons. Number one, we didn't know how safe a lot of assets were for a moment. And number two, they're actually offering us some yield for the first time in like a decade. So what's your take on the safe and secure assets?
Well, Matt, I think that is one of the things that's the most different about today's investing environment versus a couple of years ago. I mean, you now do have secure sources of cash where you can earn a real yield, nominally actually very attractive, and even a positive positive real piece. So it makes a very different backdrop to a lot of fixed income investments and obviously a lot of real estate investments as well. So I think that we are in for a somewhat different investing environment over the next 24 months with certainly I think that some of these higher rates and higher inflation is here to stay, but also lower growth. And we can argue about whether exactly we'll go into a recession and what the probabilities and scenarios of soft landings are. But in any event, growth is going to be below 2% in the developed world. And that is well below trend. So you've got higher rates, higher inflation, and lower growth. And that's the picture you're looking at as an investor right now.
Yeah, I think the OECD was out with a report talking about the same thing, that we're in for a prolonged period of lower growth, higher inflation. We've heard the same thing from a number of gigantic fund managers, for example, the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, CEO Nikolai Tangen came out and said that at the end of last year, that we're in for a prolonged period of lower returns. Do you think that's true as well, lower returns?
So lower returns is a very different idea. Because actually with higher rates, a good deal of assets are actually returning better. I do think that when we hit a period where it looks like the Fed has kind of maxed out and, you know, people begin to believe that they're going to move down, you're going to see an enormous amount of that money that has gone into money market funds come back into public fixed income. And a lot of those investments are going to be yielding quite attractive returns. So I would actually say that investments who have a vintage over the next 24 months probably are going to have somewhat higher returns than some of the ones, at least on a nominal basis, than some of the ones that we saw that were put out in, say, 2018 and 2019.
I'm looking at the money market fund assets on the Bloomberg terminal. MMFA index is something I love to pull up. $5.4 trillion. I find it hard to believe that money would pour into stocks, for example, right now, when you can get so much in safe or near as damn it to safe investments, right? Why would investors go into stocks? How much higher could we go on this market with all of the headwinds we're looking at?
So I think that there's a very good reason why so much money has moved into money market funds, most recently because of the little banking blips that we had, where basically a lot of money came out of regional lenders.
The second and third biggest bank failures in U.S. history.
It went to some of the very larger banks into their deposits, but it also really went into money market funds. And ultimately, I don't think that money necessarily comes back into stocks, but I do think it comes back into fixed income at very higher rates. And that, I think, is going to be a very attractive move, which we'll see only when people are convinced that the Fed has kind of maxed out.
We saw a surprise hike from the Bank of Canada, and usually the Bank of Canada isn't kind of front and center in my on my dashboard, but they do tend to make moves before the Fed rather than following, as a lot of other central banks do. And the fact that, you know, we expected them to hold and they raise rates, I think it's very interesting, because that's kind of the outlier take on the Fed right now. You know, Priya Misra, who was at TD last week and this week just moved to JP Morgan, she said her base case is for a hike in June, and she's definitely an outlier there, right? Most people are expecting a hold or a pause or a skip, if you will, in June. But the markets are now pricing in a hike for July. How do you look at the Fed right now?
Yeah, we've kind of fallen in line with the market term of the hawkish pause, which I think is a kind of an interesting phrase. But I think it does kind of reflect a belief that the Fed may want to have a little bit more data before they move. But then we certainly think that either at one of the next two meetings that they will kind of have one more left in them.
Just one more.
Yeah, probably one more. But it's really very data dependent, I think, at this point. I think what's much more important is how that relates to how long rates have to stay high. And I think that's where the market has it wrong. So if you look at the Fed funds futures, you're going to see that, the market still believes that these rates are coming down toward the end of this year, and certainly in the first quarter of next year that they are. I think that's where the market actually has it wrong. I think these rates are going to stay higher for longer than what's priced in right now. And that's certainly how we're positioned.
So you want to take the other side of that trade. I have a listener who wrote in and was asking, you know, how do you invest in this market, trade uncomfortably long? And then really, when is the moment that you can put a stake in the ground and have conviction? And I guess on that trade, at least, you are doing it now.
Yes, but I think obviously for any investor, it depends on your risk tolerances and your time horizons, a whole sorts of different things. I think as a market overall, when you're going to see money moving out of the money market funds is when there is belief that the Fed has peaked and is now basically started a decline. And that's when that kind of big move will happen.
But how long do you expect the pause to last? I'm
saying I think the pause is going to be longer than what the market is priced in for now, for sure.
And so we have to wait till what?
We could
2024.
We could easily be into next year before we really see that. Yeah.
What do you think, David, about the earnings picture? We had everyone comes on the program and says, "Hey, first quarter earnings weren't bad, but they weren't great." You know, and we're not expecting them to be fantastic in Q2 either. And then we get into the second half where that's where people have their recession forecast, right? So what do you expect from American companies?
So we would say that the earnings outlook will begin to gradually come down. You always see the expectation game being set now, even with the earnings that came in, which maybe were fine-ish and for some companies maybe better than expected. Even for those companies, they were managing expectations for the rest of this year. So if you read through the transcripts, what you will see is a more hawkish tone than what the actual numbers were earlier. And I think that gives you a good indication of where people are kind of expecting that to trend for sure.
That was PGIM CEO David Hunt with my co-host Matt Miller on the sidelines of this year's Bloomberg Invest Summit. For more on the event, head over to BloombergLive.com. Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, our magazine team pulls back the curtain on a Depression-era relic that is helping to prop up big banks instead of the American homebuyers it was designed to serve.
It's sort of a publicly subsidized private institution. It's a financial cooperative. So all the banks who are members pay into it a little bit with stock, and then they raise money in the debt market with bonds.
But tax-free. Tax-free bonds, right?
Yes. There's a lot of tax benefits. There's a lot of government benefits for a system that really should probably be private.
We go inside the $1.5 trillion federal home loan bank system on the other side. This is Bloomberg.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Reports this week that U.S. regulators may look to force bigger banks to lift their capital requirements by an average of 20% to help shore up the system following this year's regional banking crisis. Meantime, another American institution that was born out of a far different financial disaster is still around and more flush with cash than ever. The 90-year-old Federal Home Loan Bank system, which has ballooned to more than $1.5 trillion, is a relic of the Great Depression that had a very specific mission and yet has grown into a backstop for banks taking all kinds of risks and a diminishing role in funding new mortgages. This story in the finance section of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, Bloomberg's Matt Miller and I spoke with Bloomberg News senior wealth reporter Heather Perlberg about how FHLB funds are actually being deployed.
Earlier this year, many of us watched the kind of chaos and collapse of Silicon Valley, Silvergate, Signature, and as information about their financial health started kind of trickling out in the autopsy, it became clear that they all had tens of billions of loans from these federal home loan banks. And so we were left kind of scratching our heads thinking, well, what are these things? I mean, has federal in the name and has home lending in the name? How come they're helping prop everyone up right before they fail? So what they are is a system of 11 banks that is sort of a Depression-era relic. Now it's turned into this arcane kind of web that is really helping finance banks, helping them with daily liquidity management, and doing lots of things that have nothing to do with housing.
So how do I get hold of one of these loans? I mean,
it
unbelievable.
Sounds pretty easy, right?
You just have to be a bank, it sounds like.
Like these banks that were more focused on crypto, like Silvergate and Signature, they had billions of dollars from FHLB. And of the $1.5 trillion, it doesn't seem like very much at all goes to actual, you know, helping low-income people finance home purchases.
Right. So with the crypto-related banks, there's kind of a weird system that they have. So when you join one of these banks, if you do a certain amount of home lending or even buy a certain amount of mortgage-backed securities, you can be a member. But they don't keep tabs on that over the years. So when Silvergate kind of got out of mortgage lending, they remained a member. And even though they were doing virtually no home lending, just borrowed and borrowed and borrowed, and there's no checks on what the money is used for. So, you know, that leaves things very open for all of these banks.
So
no, they're not for home lending at all.
Right. So in other words, when these banks start to go into trouble, right, they can kind of tap into this. And at the same time, and I think something that certainly got into our craw is that this whole idea that executives were getting their bonuses, right, and being paid out while these banks were tapping into this program.
Yeah, we should point out the CEO of the San Francisco FHLB got, what, $2.5 million in pay and bonuses last year when I guess she was giving all of this money to SVB, First Republic, Silvergate. Is that going to get clawed back?
No, it's not. Huh. And they are definitely incentivized to grow their membership and to give bigger loans. And all of that is tied directly to their bonuses.
Heather, who is it? Congress that's incentivizing them? You know, who's behind this?
Well, I mean, it was created in the 1930s. It's sort of a publicly subsidized private institution. It's a financial cooperative. So all the banks who are members pay into it a little bit with stock, and then they raise money in the debt market with bonds.
But tax-free.
Yes, there's a lot of tax benefits. There's a lot of government benefits for a system that really should probably be private.
I guess one of the things I want to ask, and it's not just your Silicon Valley banks, right, or Signature, that tapped into it, Signature specifically. Big banks tap into it as well, correct?
Yeah, JP Morgan, Wells, all of these banks that have kind of scaled back on home lending use it as a way to get cheap money and kind of arbitrage or, you know, do financial management depending on which deposits are coming out and when they need money. And these banks have a lot of other sources of cheap funding. So it doesn't seem like it's something that would be mandatory or necessary for them.
Heather, what are the rules in terms of being able to tap into this? Because it sounds like within your reporting too, that there were some questionable financial institutions that maybe shouldn't have been tapping into it, but were.
The rules are, they basically look at the collateral you pledge. So once you become a member, which again, just requires a kind of minimum amount of home lending, you're in sort of for life. Because there's so many giant insurance companies, which back in the day were hugely important to the mortgage market and now do virtually no home lending. So it's sort of like a private club. And once you're in, you're in. The rules are kind of nebulous. And you can pledge mortgage-backed securities, real estate assets, all kinds of things for collateral, and then they just give you money.
Which is a problem if that collateral turns out to not be so great, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we had the second and third biggest bank failures in history.
Exactly.
And you talked, Tether, to, or you got a quote from Elliot Sloan, who's a spokesperson for the San Francisco FHLB. Elliot says the level of advances to a member is based on a careful, thoughtful, and conservative underwriting approach, which doesn't seem to be borne out by the results. And by the way, do they care at all if it has anything to do with helping lower income people buy houses?
Not really, especially when it comes to emergency funding. Silicon Valley Bank was asked to pledge $45 or $46 billion in collateral for those $15 billion in loans. So anybody looking at that can see they knew the financial health of that institution wasn't so great. I mean, that's a lot of collateral for the loans you're getting.
What's crazy is, and you include in your story, that the lion's share of U.S. home loans are now issued by non-banks, such as a Rocket Mortgage, right? And they cannot tap the FHLB system. So that is just another mind-blowing thing. Part of me thinks they get away from it because, as you also point out, this assistance from the government doesn't appear as a line in the U.S. budget. So there's no real congressional, what, oversight?
Right. I mean, they exist in this kind of limbo. It's definitely a little bit of a congressional gray area. And I think that that has benefited them greatly over the years. It's sort of like Fight Club, right? Like, nobody wants to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants anything to change because there's so many people, big banks, small banks, the executives, insurance companies. It's just benefiting too many people for them to just take it away.
But not the housing market.
A lot of housing.
Yeah,
well, exactly. The housing market, too. I mean, that's a huge problem. And a lot of housing advocates want to see that number, that 10% that they get, increase to at least 20, but that would still be really a sliver.
Do we have to blame George H.W.?
Maybe Herbert Hoover.
Okay.
You have to go back up.
You did talk to one independent director on the board of Boston's FHLB, Cornelius Hurley. It doesn't seem like he serves on the board anymore. He was there for 14 years, but he said it's embarrassing that this is a public entity and we should be demanding more from them. Do you expect that we're going to hear more about this, Heather, from board members or from Congress in the coming weeks and months?
I think so. There's a Senator Cortez Masto is very passionate about this subject. She is a bill in there trying to bring the number dedicated to the affordable housing program much higher. There are other people looking at this, and the FHFA, who regulates all of these banks, is doing a 100-year review and giving their recommendations to Congress. So it certainly seems like all of the dirt that was kicked up earlier this year is going to come to a head at some point.
And you know what? A bank can actually tap, right, Heather? More than one FHLB.
Exactly. And they like to say that that's not becoming, that's not a problem the way it used to be. But you can look at the books and see that Wells Fargo and JP Morgan belong to more than one, even now. So they may not be playing them against each other to get better terms as much as they used to. Really do compete for business a little bit.
That was Bloomberg News senior wealth reporter Heather Perlberg. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Up next, we dig into another story in the new issue about unlikely alliances between political and energy industry foes who are seeing costly new projects held by mountains of red tape.
Some of the projects we've written about, it can take 17 years and there's still not steel in the ground. And what that does is it costs companies billions of dollars. It slows down the energy transition and the fight against climate change that we're trying to get going with all the clean energy. Just a really inefficient, bureaucratic way that it's set up right now.
The push for permitting reform explained. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Here in the U.S., the most elusive piece of any new energy project isn't materials such as copper or steel, labor, or even capital. It's a permit. Without the right approvals, nothing gets built. And that's why unlikely alliances are coming together. The renewables and fossil fuel industries and Democrats and Republicans in Washington are uniting in their push to streamline the country's thicket of regulations. Who'da thunk? You can find this story in the economics section of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week. For more, I caught up with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Jill Weber and Bloomberg News energy reporter Josh Saul, who co-wrote the piece.
Permitting system in the U.S. is so old and so complicated that to build, for example, a transmission line that's going to carry clean power across the U.S., to build a new gas pipeline, to build a new solar farm that's going to create that kind of clean electricity that we want, can take years, can take 10 years. Some of the projects we've written about, it can take 17 years and there's still not steel in the ground. And what that does is it costs companies billions of dollars. you know, it slows down the energy transition and the fight against climate change that we're trying to get going with all the clean energy. Just a really inefficient, bureaucratic way that it's set up right now. And that's created some strange bedfellows, like you said, where you have oil companies and clean energy companies and Republicans and Democrats, you know, folks who usually do not shake hands, all getting together and saying, hey, we need to make this better.
So there's a side in this story that Bloomberg has covered before, but it was a reminder of just how hellish this can look like. There's this 500-mile-long SunZia Southwest transmission projects. How bad can this permitting stuff get, Josh?
It really bad. That the SunZia line, which is going to carry clean power, so solar power from big solar fields in New Mexico to the Phoenix area, and that's important if you care about climate change for the idea that we'll be displacing, you know, natural gas-fired plants in the Phoenix area with electrons created by the sun that'll be flowing from New Mexico. But in order to do that, you have to build a power line to carry them, those 520 miles. That's really hard to do. So that process has been going on for 17 years. And it's not a one-off. I wrote a story last year about a different power line, which would carry electricity from the windy plains of Wyoming, a really windy area, to down towards Las Vegas, again, displacing natural gas-fired plants and other kinds of fossil fuels. And that's also been hung up for closer to two decades than one decade at this point, because it takes so long to get all of the federal permits, to get all the private permissions, to cross all of the different kind of land that a project like that would go over.
Hey, Josh, can we talk pizza?
Yes.
I love this quote in your story.
I'm surprised we got this far into the conversation. One of the energy analysts we spoke to had a fun analogy. And this gets to the idea that, yes, there are strange bedfellows, both Republicans, Democrats, oil and gas, solar and wind folks all want to reform the system. But an energy analyst had a good point, which is that, yeah, in a broad sense, everyone wants reform of the system. They all want, hey, yeah, let's order pizza. But actually getting down to the specifics of, well, what should the reform look like is as hard as when you have a room full of people and you're trying to decide whether you're going to be ordering veggie pizzas, meat pizzas, anchovy pizzas, pineapple, Hawaiian. And the point there is that, you know, the oil folks want less federal oversight. The transmission folks want more federal oversight because they want the states overruled, because the states are sometimes the ones who, you know, who put up roadblocks, as two examples. And the point is that it's easy to say, yeah, we want permitting reform, but it's a lot the same way it's easy to say, hey, let's order pizza, but it's a lot harder to drill down and say, this is actually what it should look like when you have lots of different groups that want different things.
That was Bloomberg News energy reporter Josh Saul, along with Joel Weber, who's sticking around for our next segment. And that wraps up our first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Ahead in our next hour, our cover story on the United States' long, tortured journey to mass-produce batteries for electric vehicles.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
I'm Carol Masser, Matt Miller filling in for Tim this week. Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including insights on what to do when money and love converge with life's biggest decisions before you. Plus, we speak with the founder of Connecticut-based Blackbridge Motors, which transforms vintage vehicles into finely engineered works of art that can drive better than ever before. First up this hour, this week's cover story, also related to autos, specifically America's losing battle to take the lead in electrical vehicle battery production. It began with the rise and fall of a company called A123, a U.S. startup that was a bit too early for the EV market. For more, we turn to Bloomberg Businessweek editor Jill Weber and Bloomberg News auto reporter Gabrielle Coppola, who examines the nation's blind faith in shareholder capitalism and our need to rethink our approach to innovation.
I wanted to profile this guy named Mujeeb Ijaz, who is an entrepreneur who's trying to build an American battery company now here in Michigan. He's actually a veteran of A123. And as I dug into the story, I learned the story of A123, which, as Joel mentioned, this was a company that had a brief moment. You know, think back to 2011, 2012. GM and Chrysler had been bailed out. The Obama administration was trying to push them to build more fuel-efficient cars. And A123 thought they had a chance there. But, you know, the heart of the story is really this one question is, does America need to kind of tinker with or rethink the rules of our free enterprise American capitalism to compete with China? Because what happened is there wasn't an immediate success. You know, EV range was still kind of weak. Gas prices were coming down. So they were making batteries, but there weren't enough. Nobody wanted to buy EVs. Tesla wasn't a big thing yet. So they went bankrupt, and they were bought by a Chinese auto parts maker called Wansheng, which kind of dialed back their ambitions and had them focus on stop-start batteries, which is if you ever, you know, driven a car, you notice you're at a red light, and your car, instead of idling and burning gas, it just shuts off. That's what they do. That's what A123 does. So, and so it's just so ironic when you look now at where the country is and there's all this anxiety over, you know, geopolitical tension, economic warfare with China. And I'm not sitting here trying to promote, you know, there's a lot of things you could say about China that are critical. You know, they certainly have violated a lot of IP, American intellectual property, and that's in my story. But the story is really more about looking in the mirror for America.
Well, let's go there. Like, how did we get there? Like, if you had to point your finger at maybe one or two things, how is it that we kind of screwed this up?
I think the biggest thing is that we did not value manufacturing. And I say this as a reporter who worked in New York for a long time and moved to Detroit 4 years ago and has been covering the auto industry. For many decades, our idea of economic growth was we don't need manufacturing. We should just outsource it. It's a commodity. And, you know, we can just write apps or work at Walmart or in the service industry or whatever, and that's going to be fine. Obviously, that has not been fine. And, you know, one of the things that is in the story that Joel will know, the former Intel CEO, Andy Grove, wrote this amazing opinion piece in Business Week in 2010. Where he warned all of this was going to happen. He said, America is losing the means to scale its own technology. And if you don't control the means to make things, then you don't understand them, and you're losing part of the process. So what we thought was a commodity is actually really valuable. And we are learning that the hard way now. And then, you know, the open of the story is this very symbolic moment that, you know, Ford Motor Company is building a new, brand new battery factory right here in Michigan. You know, big win for the state, lots of jobs, investment, all that. But they have to license the technology from CATL, which is the world's biggest battery manufacturer, and it is a Chinese company that was nurtured on, you know, subsidies from the Chinese government. Now, I'm not knocking CATL for, you know, trying to have a big business and being entrepreneurial. That's part of their success. It's not all subsidies. The chairman, Robin Zung, is obviously like a very smart guy, and he's built something great. But the crazy thing is that the technology that Ford is licensing, LFP, that's not to get too technical here, but LFP batteries, lithium iron phosphate batteries, are more stable and they're cheaper than what you typically see in EVs today, because those are lithium ion batteries made with nickel. And that technology, that the fact that you could, that chemistry works in batteries, was discovered by Americans at the University of Texas Austin. So we discovered this. We had a company that tried to commercialize it, and then we threw it away because we believe that free market is everything, and if you can't survive in the Darwinistic moment of the free market, then you don't deserve to exist, period.
I want to just quickly ask you about CATL, or CATL. I was in Detroit a couple weeks ago.
Last week.
Talking to people at the Ford Motor Company about this. And I know that some on the right, including the governor of Virginia, have called this kind of a Trojan horse, because they have gone to Michigan, the Chinese, to help Ford set up this plant. And the Chinese are going to stay there as advisors on the project, right? Is there any concern that it is kind of a Trojan horse operation, or is this just kind of political
theater? Yeah, I think that's a fabulous question, Matt. And like most things in life, there's a lot of nuance in that question. It's not black and white. So do I think CATL has anything but the best of intentions of trying to grow their business? No. I mean, these guys have a lot of capacity in China, and they need to find places to sell it outside China. And so they're psyched that they can do that with Ford. I also don't think that, just like any supplier, you don't always, I mean, you don't want to get, you try, just like, think about the irony of this. You know, used to be GM and Ford and Volkswagen, everybody went to China, and they were forced to do joint ventures with Chinese companies to teach them how to make cars, but make them better at making cars. All the car companies hid their IP about how to make an engine as much as they could. They walled it off, even though they had a partnership, right? Because they didn't want China to get that. Well, China said, okay, great, you can have your engines because we're going to make batteries. But still, I think, so in terms of the risk, what people need to wrap their head around there is that CATL has the IP that America needs, not the other way around, okay? So that's one thing to think about. On the other hand, I'm not going to say that Glenn Youngkin or any of these Republicans are completely unjustified in being very cautious and being very careful and looking at this, because there are no Chinese companies that do not have, they're not under the influence of the Chinese government. It's a command economy. It's, I don't think CATL is special. I think that's how it works, you know? So I think that we have to be pragmatic, because we are behind. And if you look, if you spoke to Ford, if you spoke to the folks, you know, GM, forget CATL. If you just want to buy processed lithium to make a battery, you can't get out. You can't do that without China yet. You know, I mean, that's what the Inflation Reduction Act and what the Biden administration is trying to really accelerate, is building that supply chain so we can do that. But we're not there yet. It doesn't happen overnight. We've been outsourcing for 50 years. Now all of a sudden we woke up and we realized, oh crap, we need to make things. You know, it's not going to happen overnight. But I mean, I think the biggest risk is that either politicians or investors do not have the stomach for that, because it kind of, you know, we have to rethink who we are and how we do things. I'm not at all suggesting we would ever want to lose or diminish the, you know, free markets and free enterprise and the freedom that makes all those people want to come study in the United States, right? We are great because of that freedom.
So but what you're talking about, Gabby, is ultimately, you know, America's innovation machine. And that has been the thing that has gotten us where we are. And yet there, what you're ultimately talking about here is the lack of an industrial policy, right? America has no industrial policy. I'm curious, when you talk to some of the folks that are quoted in the story, what kind of insights did they have to say about what that could even look like here?
You know, I think that's a great question, and I think it's a hard question. And, you know, that's certainly a question for economists and people in government. And, you know, I think that private capital, there want to be some competition here so that the best can survive, you know. But I think a little bit of runway, you know, I think if you look at, you know, what the Biden administration is trying to do now, I think being more willing to support, if you have, like, think about, we're already doing this, right? First of all, the Department of Defense does it already, okay? And the Department of Energy does it because all the time they are giving loans and seeding new startups and technologies. And that is also part of what the Biden administration has been doing. But the thing is, they give them money for, like, to get it out of the lab. But then when it comes to the hard work of, like, building something, that's when you're supposed to go to the private market. But guess what? Battery manufacturing is really, really hard. Just ask Elon Musk. There's going to be bumps in the road. And the question right. is, you know, if there's one, like A123, what pushed them over the edge was they had a recall. It wasn't a horrific problem, but it was a problem. But that gave, I mean, there were other things going on, but that gave everyone cold feet and they dropped them like a hot potato. You know, if you believe something is strategic, then you need to treat it like it's strategic. And I think one of the other big risks to us is that, you know, the U.S. every 4 years or every 8 years, we have this major pendulum switch in our swing in our policy, right? We don't stay the course. We're inconsistent. Mm. We're not long-term. We're short-term.
And that was Bloomberg News auto reporter Gabrielle Coppola and Bloomberg Business Week editor Jill Weber on this week's cover story. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Still ahead, we'll stay on the road and hear from the head of a company that aims to create one-of-a-kind luxury vehicles that bridge the gap between today's performance demands and classic designs. The founder of Blackbridge Motors on how the process works and how much it'll cost you. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Bloomberg News noting last month the projected size of the collectible car market in the U.S., $18.7 billion. Growth in value of classic vehicles as an asset class last year, 25%. And the average age of buyers on the collectible car auction platform, 44. I mean, who doesn't love a classic car from any era? But, without today's technological bells and whistles and high-performance systems, if we could only do something to change that. Enter Blackbridge Motors, which takes vintage vehicles and transforms them. Scott Gilbert is the company's founder and lead designer. He joined me and Matt Miller, and I gotta say, Matt was in his glory as Scott broke down the business.
So we started a couple years ago with the sole focus, and you know, I think Matt pointed out a lot of great issues that we had really tried to solve day one. It was really about taking this iconic, aesthetically appealing platform that we all like the look of these older cars. And we wanted to engineer out a lot of the old car problems. So everything from driveline solutions to electronics to brakes, all of that is modernized and upgraded. So our core business focus is taking the old car out of old cars, but leaving all the aesthetics and the true to period look and feel of the car very period correct.
So let's talk about the process and how this works. You guys started, I think, with Defenders, right?
Yeah, we do a lot of those, yes.
So, and you know, something really interesting about the old Land Rover Defenders is they're impossible to import from overseas. A car has to be 25 years old before you're allowed to bring it over here. And by that time, it's in pretty bad shape in terms of drivability, right? So how does this work, Scott? If I buy an older Defender, like Doug DeMuro has this yellow Defender, you know, that looks really cool, but is probably very crappy to drive. If he brings you his yellow Defender, can you, you know, put in a new V8? Can you put in new suspension? Can you put in disc brakes on all four wheels? Is that how it works?
Yeah, there's two ways. If you bring us an existing car, we can upgrade and modernize what you have currently. The other pathway, which is becoming much more common, is to start with a donor vehicle that really is just about transferring title and ownership, and we rebuild you a new car that is new in every respect. And, you know, the Land Rover Defenders are a great example of being able to purchase OEM body panels that are brand new from the factory, new frames, new General Motors performance engines, and rebuilding a car as you would in a factory environment. Just when your finished product is completed, it looks like a classic vintage car with really no vintage parts on it. So it has all the aesthetic appeal, but everything's brand new from the brakes,
by the way,
to the bodywork, to the engine.
What? The GM V8 is the real game changer there, right? Because I don't know what these vehicles came with. They came with like 2.5 liter five cylinders, like something horrible that produced a maximum of 120 horsepower. But you drop in like an LT4 from GM, and all of a sudden you're looking at 500 horsepower in a Defender.
Correct. And you have to remember, these cars, you know, the Defender 110s are almost 6,000 pounds. So while it sounds like a lot of power, really the reason behind integrating that solution starts with reliability and safety. And yes, do you get a performance increase? Absolutely. But it feels like a modern car. Most big sedans and big SUVs come with 400, 500, 600 horsepower from the factory currently. So doing that to a similar weight vehicle just gets you, again, that modern, reliable, consistent feel.
All right. So, Scott, I'm going to sound like the wife of someone who's really into cars, because I am one. And how much does all this cost to do like a conversion?
So most, if you're starting from scratch, the average price point is anywhere between $200,000 and $250,000. And it can go up from there if you choose some, you know, really expensive leathers and creature comforts. Wow. But for the most part, it's about a $200,000 option. But when you compare them to newer luxury vehicles, you know, things are getting much more expensive. And, you know, in the past, we looked like a very expensive option. And I think now you're starting to see people cross shop a new G-Wagon versus something unique and bespoke to them and classic. And the price points are relatively similar.
We're on radio, obviously. But for those who are watching on YouTube and Bloomberg Originals, you can see some of the work that Black Ridge Motors does. Supply chain, I'm curious about this and getting pieces. Because, again, husband has a vintage car. Getting the pieces, like the supply chains, that alone is like, you know, when he gets something, he feels like he's won the jackpot. How difficult is it? Are you guys easy to get the pieces?
Well, it's been challenging. And I think, you know, a lot of what we did smart early on was, you know, recognize that this wasn't going to get better anytime soon. And, you know, you start to place larger orders, recognizing that there's going to be fractional fills. So it's been challenging. It's really been an exercise in inventory management and proper ordering. And, you know, at the end of the day, financial budgeting for larger inventory carry. So it's been a difficult couple of years just in terms of making sure that you can honor timelines of customers and get the parts that you need to build them. But I'd say it's getting better. We're seeing, again, some signs of stress just in terms of turnaround times and production lead times getting longer rather than shorter. So I don't think we're out of the weeds yet, but it's certainly been a point that we've had to navigate pretty sharply over the last couple of years.
It seems like your business is growing pretty rapidly, though. I've been lurking on the website for a couple years now, and I see, you know, the banners pop up. Every time I log into a website from another company, your banners pop up there, so your marketing is great. You have Land Cruisers also. You have the Ford Broncos, the classic ones that you do. And that now I see you are offering a Mustang product as well as a Corvette.
And we've tried over the years to really invest in R&D and recognize that as tastes change, as, you know, what's the new hot car changes, we didn't want to be parked into one specific make and model. We wanted to be solutions based. So our company provides solutions for classic and vintage vehicles, and we offer a variety of different makes and models that integrate a lot of the same solutions. But to your point earlier, there's a lot of emotional attachment to some cars. And as tastes change and people recognize the value of, for instance, the 1965 Mustang, which is becoming really, really popular, we want to be at the forefront of both technology and solutions to be able to provide a similar modern experience in a variety of different shapes and sizes.
What's your story, Scott? How did you get into this?
So I previously was in a totally different career. I was in finance before this, and I made the decision to leave and get into cars for a variety of reasons, but it was really rooted in just a natural recognition that a lot of car-based companies don't put the customer first. And it was something that I learned very quickly in finance. If you don't do that, it's just a matter of time until you have to find a different career. So I wanted to take a lot of what I thought was smart in my previous career. I'd always been into automobiles and cars, and I thought I could provide some good, unique solutions and provide a different customer experience. And we started very small and very humbly, and we've been lucky enough over the last couple of years to put together a great team and grow organically.
What's the industry like? You know, there have been others in the past. I think about Singer, right? They do this with Porsches. Icon also has done kind of the SUVs out on the West Coast. Are you facing more and more competition?
I'd say recently, yeah. There's a lot of, you know, players popping up and recognizing, I think, the value in the space. So, you know, I'd say there is definitely more entrance into the space than there were certainly 5 or 6 years ago. I think you're starting to see demand grow in a variety of different ways, which is a good thing. And, you know, that leads to providers, you know, coming online and providing some good solutions and just natural competition. 5, 6 years ago, there's only a handful of companies that did what we did. Now I think there's a growing population, which is both exciting and encouraging.
Do you guys do any EV conversions?
So we have the engineering done. The one thing that we always run into is, you know, parts availability is very, very challenging. You're fighting some very large companies that are are obviously very well funded, that are funding for battery technology and just, you know, simple parts. So it is an expensive upgrade to do correctly. And when we're talking about the reliability and especially the safety component of an internal combustion engine in its current format, and how many decades of proven test miles have been put on those platforms versus a relatively new technology that's relatively unknown, very expensive.
That was Scott Gilbert, founder and lead designer at Blackbridge Motors in Norwalk, Connecticut. He joined me and a giddy Matt Miller. Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, while buying a $250,000 luxury vehicle may be a big decision for a select few, most of us are faced with far more pressing choices on a regular basis.
The conventional wisdom is that you should separate career decisions, financial decisions, make those with your head, from love decisions, relationship decisions. Just follow your heart. And the reason that I found those decisions so difficult is, as Myra described in her class, that money and love decisions are inextricably linked.
We lay out an intelligent roadmap to help make those decisions when we come back. This is Bloomberg.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
So, Matt, I bet you've made some pretty big decisions in your life.
I thought you were going to say pretty big mistakes. I have made a lot of mistakes in my romantic life that bled over into my financial life in a negative way.
Really?
For years and years, as soon as a woman even said hi to me back, I would say, do you want to move in with me? And it never worked out well.
That is Matt in a nutshell. Yeah. That really is. But needless to say, he's moved along and is in a much, much better place. This brings us to our next two guests, who are the authors of a book, Money and Love, An Intelligent Roadmap for Life's Biggest Decisions. And with us is Myra Strober, labor economist at Stanford University, here in studio along with Abby Davison, a social innovation leader. Let me kick it off with you guys. First of all, why this book? And I know you guys have been researching women and following, but tell us about how you came to say, all right, we got to write this book. Who wants to start?
Well, I've been teaching a course first at Berkeley and then at Stanford for, gosh, close to 50 years on work and family.
Yeah.
And Abby was a student of mine in 2008, along with the man that she married, her husband. They were not even engaged then, but they both took the class. And I asked them to come back and speak once they had children of their own and were in the thick of all the decisions about which we write. And so Abby and I were having lunch in August of 2018, And I stopped teaching this course in about a year before that. And I said to Abby that I wanted to write a book about the class because I didn't want the information just to be available to Stanford students. And so when we had lunch, she said to me, how's the book coming? And I sheepishly said, I haven't written a word. And she said, with MBA style, you need an accountability partner.
Let's do it.
And no. She wanted me to be accountable to somebody. And I looked at her and I thought, no, I need a co-author. So even though our book tells people not to make decisions on the spot, I made a decision right there and then to ask her to be my co-author.
I love it.
And she accepted.
And this book, the course material, which I took now 15 years ago, totally changed my life.
It
was a light bulb moment for me because the conventional wisdom is that you should separate career decisions, financial decisions, make those with your head, from love decisions, relationship decisions. Just follow your heart. And the reason that I found those decisions so difficult is, as Myra described in her class, that money and love decisions are inextricably linked.
Yeah.
You cannot separate them. And actually, if you do, you're more likely to it's more likely to lead to decisions that you regret. And so if you can think about decisions holistically and apply a framework to help you slow down the decision-making process, you are more likely to have decisions that leave you fulfilled and have purpose and meaning.
I feel like we could do a 60-minute therapy session. Well, so,
I mean, just
seriously?
I'm sure everybody talks to you guys about this book, talks about his or her own personal experience. So when I hear you say that, I realize that, you know, in all of my relationships that failed in the past, typically failed because at first I wanted to go from 0 to 60 in like 2 seconds. And not just romantically, but also financially. I always felt like if I buy you dinner, if I pay your rent, if I subsidize your master's degree, then it's gonna work out better because you're gonna love me even more. But that always ended up being a mistake. If I had not done those things from the get-go, the relationship would have been much healthier, and maybe they wouldn't have lasted, you know, till eternity, but they wouldn't have failed so miserably. So when I was looking through this book last week, I thought, I really wish I had read this book in 2003, and I'm sure a lot of people tell you that.
Well, the key is, and I don't know if you did this in those failed relationships, but maybe before you offer to subsidize the master's degree, have a conversation about your money experiences growing up.
That was always top secret. In my family also, my father has never even told my mother about his finances, which are essentially, you know, our finances as a family. In my family, that just wasn't something that you spoke about when you were growing up.
Well, you're not alone. Money is a very taboo topic. And so I think one of the wonderful things that Myra's class did and what we aim to do in our book is to demystify those conversations, to encourage people to have them before they feel ready.
Right.
And that was one of the things that I had to do with this man who I had only been dating for about a year when we found ourselves in Myra's class.
Did it work?
We've been married for almost 14 years. We have 2 kids.
Well, I think this is really relevant. I also think, you know, more and more, I feel like society has changed in a big way, right? Women working, women supporting their families. I mean, my husband and I did a flip where he supported us half the time. And then I, in the last half of our, you know, we're still married, you know, we just reversed our roles. Having said that, so your heart says, this person's for me. What's the conversation you should then have with that person to figure out if financially it's going to work as well?
So before you even get to the conversation with the other person, we talk about a framework, which we call the 5 C's. And the first C in the framework is clarify. So clarify what it is you're looking for. And, you know, don't think about this like choosing a pizza topping. You know, don't think about, oh, I want a little bit of this and a little bit of that. What are your core values? What are you looking for in your own life?
Did you do that with your...
Well, we didn't have the framework in the class.
You didn't.
But now we use it, actually, to make all of our major life decisions, including we both are starting new companies. And so we absolutely did clarify our core values and talk about them with each other.
And then the next step is to communicate those core values to the person you're thinking of spending your life with or the person you want to help because you love them and they're about to retire and you wonder how they're going to make it.
So Matt, you love cars. So I'm curious, what's the conversation? Matt is
This is a difficult conversation that I'm having right now with my wife and my financial planner because I can't afford to continue buying cars and motorcycles at the rate I have. Now, I've just had a child and I'm having another one. If we want to send them to college, right? So, yeah,
it's tricky.
But it's not the kind of conversation I really want to have because I don't like reality, you know? I'd prefer to just continue to spend beyond my means, but I assume you address that in some way as well.
These are uncomfortable conversations. There's no doubt about it. And I always think about it as going up to a huge diving board, standing at the top of the diving board,
right,
knowing that you've got to jump into that pool or else go down the ladder, and knowing that that diving board is not going to get any shorter in terms of the distance to the water, and take the plunge. Just dive in. I mean, you're already married, but we're suggesting that people have these conversations way before that, when they're still dating, when they don't feel that they're ready to have the conversation.
Well, but it's too late for me. And the idea is, as you said,
but you can still communicate.
You can still use this system in your everyday life, even after you're married.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so I would say for you, what is it that cars or that motorcycles mean to you?
Everything.
I'm sorry.
Well, no, it was everything until
everything.
I had children.
That's
and
true.
Now, to be honest with you,
that's
it's
true.
Not so much.
Yeah.
And so maybe there is a way to incorporate your family into that love. And so one of the questions actually that we encourage people to ask one another early on is, what do you spend reckless amounts of money on? And so that might have been a question that would lead you to say, actually, cars and motorcycles. And that could start a conversation about, okay, well, what is that for you? Oh, it's escape. Oh, it's excitement. Oh, it's adventure. Well, how do we incorporate those things into our relationship before we spend six figures on a car?
Is it similar akin to, I have a brother and his wife, and like they had like a whiteboard, I forget what you call it, and you basically like put your like goals on it together, whether it's financial goals and so on and so forth, and they make sure that they're kind of on the same page about it, but they both contribute to it and they work towards it. So it's kind of that idea, right?
Absolutely. And it starts, as Myra mentioned, by being really clear and then communicating with the other person or people. And then it's about being very clear on your choices. So when we are in the throes of a big life decision, we often see the two extremes. We see, do I marry this person or break up with them? And the truth is that there are a lot of options in between those two extremes, and we don't always see them when we are just looking at the question ourselves. So we also suggest people check in, that's the fourth C, with someone who is a friend or family or trusted resource to help give them ideas of other choices they might have that they don't see at first blush.
Our thanks to labor economist and Stanford professor Myra Strober and her former student turned co-author, social innovation consultant Abby Davison. Pick up their new book, Money and Love, An Intelligent Roadmap for Life's Biggest Decisions. By the way, the all-important fifth C that we didn't get to in that excerpt, consequences. Head over to our podcast feed for the entire conversation and more on Matt Miller's personal life. You get to hear it all. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, the company dedicated to uniting retailers, manufacturers, foundations, and individuals to help provide people in need with much needed merchandise. We speak with the head of Delivering Good when we come back. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Since 1985, Delivering Good has distributed over $3 billion in new clothing, home goods, toys, furniture, books, and other consumer products through its network of more than 800 community partners. And they send it to at-risk children, families, and individuals. The group does it by uniting retailers, manufacturers, foundations, and individuals. With an update on the work they are doing and with a pulse check on the retail sector, Matt Miller and I turn to Delivering Good board member Jaren Bloom. She is also group president of retail at Michael Kors and Delivering Good president and CEO Matt Fasciano.
It's a difficult time for many people, both in the industry and outside of the industry. And I think we have the great fortune of having some very committed brand partners that support the work of Delivering Good. And that allows us to keep doing the important work we're doing. And I think, you know, the reality is the need is as great as ever right now. So we continue to rely on them and have great appreciation for their support of our work.
It does seem like we have a real bifurcation. I mean, we talked 10 years ago about wealth inequality, but the pandemic seems to have worsened that, right? The higher income consumer is still able to spend and has
right.
a fat bank account, whereas the lower income American is having to put things on credit card if they even have that kind of access. What kind of What kind of economic situation, Jaron, are you seeing right now at Michael Kors?
Well, in North America specifically, I mean, the climate is definitely, the consumer sentiment is a little tough right now. It feels, we're feeling it in all of our businesses, and it's not just exclusive to Michael Kors. It's
right.
Industry-wide. So, listen, you know, the economic situation, recession looming, consumers are nervous. We're lapping COVID spend of last year, so we're compared to last year, and that was post-COVID spend. On top of that, there's a lot of talk about the transition from spending from goods to services and experiences. Mm-hmm. All of that combined is creating a somewhat tricky landscape right now, in North America specifically. So not the same necessarily in some of the other regions. So there's a lot of travel, and there's more traffic to stores and in Europe, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of folks going from the U.S. to Europe, especially this summer. Asia's finally out and shopping, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of growth and a lot of activity and a lot of excitement in Asia.
By the way, I'm curious because, you know, retail and in general, the consumer is affected broadly by the economy. But I wonder in fashion, if there's something that's hot, you know, if there's something that's new and completely different, does that change the picture a little bit?
It does. It incentivizes. Yeah. I mean, we're, you know, in the fashion industry, we don't sell anything that anybody needs. So creating the demand is a big motivator. And for sure, we're seeing in our business that something that's new and it's innovative and really fashion, customers are biting at that.
So is there anything like that? I mean, when I don't know because I don't hang around in that world too often. But if all of a sudden, you know, we go from dark blue heavy denim to acid wash ripped jeans, does everybody have to go out and change? Is there something like that right now in fashion?
I don't think so.
That's Delivering Good President and CEO Matt Fasciano and Group President of Retail at Michael Kors, Jaron Bloom. She is also a Delivering Good board member. That full interview on our podcast feed. And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday starting at 3 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio and on SiriusXM Channel 119. You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News. We're simulcast on Bloomberg Originals, available on Bloomberg.com/originals and streaming platforms including Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Samsung TV Plus, and more. Find our Bloomberg Business Week podcast at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. The latest edition of the magazine, available on newsstands now, at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and always on the Bloomberg terminal. Have a good and safe weekend, everyone. For Matt Miller, I'm Carol Masser. Stay with us. Today's top stories and global business headlines are coming up.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.